But Nagarjuna went on to say, you mustn't cling to the void. You have to void the void. And so the void of non-void is the great state, as it were, of Nagarjuna's Buddhism. But you must remember that all that has been voided, all that has been denied, are those concepts in which one has hitherto attempted to pin down what is real. In Zen Buddhist texts, they say, you cannot nail a peg into the sky. And so, to be a man of the sky, a man of the void, is also called a man not depending on anything. And when you're not hung on anything, you are the only thing that isn't hung on anything, which is the universe, which doesn't hang, you see. Where would it hang? It has no place to fall on, even though it may be dropping. There will never be the crash of it landing on concrete floor somewhere. But the reason for that is that it won't crash below because it doesn't hang above. And so there is a poem in Chinese which speaks of such a person as having above not a tile to cover the head, below not an inch of ground on which to stand. And you see, this, which to people like us who are accustomed to rich imageries of the divine, the loving Father in heaven who has laid down the eternal laws, O Word of God incarnate, O Wisdom from above, O Truth unchanged, unchanging, O Light of life and love, the Wisdom which from the hallowed page, a lantern for our footsteps, shines out from age to age. See, so that's very nice. We feel we know where we are, and that it's all been written down, and that in heaven the Lord God is resplendent with glory, with all the colors of the rainbow, with all the saints and angels around and everything like that. So we feel that it's positive, that we've got a real rip-roaring gutsy religion full of color and so on. But it doesn't work that way. The more clear your image of God, the less powerful it is, because you're clinging to it. The more it's an idol. But voiding it completely isn't going to turn it into what you think of as void. What would you think of as void? Being lost in a fog, so that it's white all around and you can't see in any direction. Being in the darkness, or the color of your head as perceived by your eyes, that's probably the best illustration that we would think of as the void. Because it isn't black and it isn't white, it isn't anything. But that's still not the void. Take the lesson from the head. How does your head look to your eyes? Well, I tell you, it looks like what you see out in front of you, because all that you see out in front of you is how you feel inside your head. So it's the same with this. And so, for this reason, the great sixth patriarch, Huineng in China, said that it was a great mistake for those who were practicing Buddhist meditation to try to make their minds empty. And a lot of people tried to do that. They sat down and tried to have no thoughts whatever in their minds. And not only no thoughts, but no sense experiences. So they'd close their eyes, they'd plug up their ears, and generally go in for sensory deprivation. Well, sensory deprivation, if you know how to handle it, can be quite interesting. It'll have the same sort of results as taking LSD or something like that. And there are special labs made nowadays where you can be sensorily deprived to an amazing degree. But if you're a sort of a good yogi, this doesn't bother you at all, send some people crazy. But if you dig this world, you can have a marvelous time in a sensory deprivation scene. Also, especially if they get you into a condition of weightlessness. Skin divers going down below a certain number of feet, I don't know exactly how far it is, but get a sense of weightlessness. And at the same time, this deprives them of every sense of responsibility. They become alarmingly happy. And they have been known to simply take off their masks and offer them to a fish. And of course, they then drown. So if you skin dive and you have to keep your eye on the time. You have to have a water watch or a friend who's got a string attached to you. If you go down that far, and at a certain specific time, you know you have got to get back. However happy you feel, and however much inclined to say, survival, what the hell's the point of that? And this is happening to the men who go out into space. They will increasingly find that they have to have automatic controls to bring them back. Quite aside that they can't change in any way from the spaceship. Now, isn't that interesting? Can you become weightless here? I said a little while ago that the person who really accepts transience begins to feel weightless. When Suzuki was asked, what is it like to have experienced Satori, enlightenment, he said, it's just like ordinary everyday experience, but about 2 inches off the ground. Zhuangzi, the Taoist, said, it is easy enough to stand still. The difficulty is to walk without touching the ground. Why do you feel so heavy? It isn't just a matter of gravitation and weight. It is that you feel that you are carrying your body around. So there is a koan in Zen Buddhism. Who is it that carries this corpse around? And so when you feel it, common speech expresses this all the time. Life is a drag. I feel I'm just dragging myself around. My body is a burden to me. To whom? To whom? That's the question. You see? And when there is nobody left for whom the body can be a burden, the body isn't a burden. But so long as you fight it, it is. So then, when there is nobody left to resist the thing that we call change, which is simply another word for life, and when we dispel the illusion that we think our thoughts, instead of being just a stream of thoughts, and that we feel our feelings instead of being just feelings, it's like saying, you know, to feel the feelings is a redundant expression. It's like saying, actually, I hear sounds. For there are no sounds which are not heard. Hearing is sound. Seeing is sight. You don't see sights. Sightseeing is a ridiculous word. You could just say either sighting or seeing, one or the other, but sightseeing is nonsense. So we keep doubling our words, and this doubling is comparable to oscillation in an electrical system where there's too much feedback, where you remember in the old-fashioned telephone where the receiver was separate from the mouthpiece, the transmitter. If you wanted to annoy someone who was abusing you on the telephone, You could make them listen to themselves by putting the receiver to the mouthpiece. But it actually didn't have that effect. It set up oscillation. It started to howl. It could be very, very hard on the ears. The same way, if you turn a television camera at the monitor, that is to say, the television set in the studio, the whole thing will start to jiggle. The visual picture will be of oscillation. Like that. And the same thing happens here. When you get to think that you think your thoughts, the you standing aside the thoughts has the same sort of consequence as seeing double. And then you think, can I observe the thinker thinking the thoughts? Or, I am worried, and I ought not to worry, but because I can't stop worrying, I'm worried because I worry. And you see where that could lead to. It leads to exactly the same situation that happens in the telephone, and that is what we call anxiety, trembling. But this discipline that we're talking about of Nagarjuna's abolishes anxiety, because you discover that no amount of anxiety makes any difference to anything that's going to happen. In other words, from the first standpoint, the worst is going to happen. You're all going to die. And don't just put it off in the back of your mind and say, I'll consider that later. It's the most important thing to consider now, because it enables you, it is the mercy of nature, because it's going to enable you to let go and not defend yourself all the time, waste all the energies in self-defense. So, this doctrine of the void is really the basis of the whole Mahayana movement in Buddhism. It's marvelous. The void, of course, is in Buddhist imagery symbolized by a mirror, because a mirror has no color and yet reflects all colors. When this man I talked to you of, Huineng, said that you shouldn't just try to cultivate a blank mind, what he said was this. The void, shunyata, is like space. Now, space contains everything. The mountains, the oceans, the stars, the good people and the bad people, the plants, the animals, everything. Now, the mind in us, the true mind, is like that. You will find that when Buddhists use the word mind, they've several words for mind, but I'm not going into the technicality at the moment. They mean space. See, space is your mind. It's very difficult for us to see that, because we think we're in space and look out at it. There are various kinds of space. There's visual space, distance. There is audible space, silence. There is temporal space, as we say, between times. There is musical space, so-called distance between intervals, or the intervals between tones, rather. It's quite a different kind of space than temporal or visual space. There's tangible space. But all these spaces, you see, are the mind. They're the dimensions of consciousness. And so this great space, which every one of us apprehends from a slightly different point of view, in which the universe moves, this is the mind. So it's represented by a mirror, because although the mirror has no color, it is for that reason able to receive all the different colors. Meister Eckhart said, in order to see color, my eye has to be free from color. So in the same way, in order not only to see, but also to hear, to think, to feel, you have to have an empty head. And the reason why you are not aware of your brain cells, unless you're only aware of your brain cells if you get a tumor or something in the brain, when it gets sick. But in the ordinary way, you're totally unconscious of your brain cells. They're void. And for that reason, you see everything else. So that's the central principle of the Mahayana. And it works in such a way, you see, that it releases people from the notion that Buddhism is clinging to the void. This was very important when Buddhism went into China. The Chinese really dug this, because Chinese are a very practical people. And when they found these Hindu Buddhist monks trying to empty their minds and to sit perfectly still and not to engage in any family activities, they were celibates, Chinese thought they were crazy. Why do that? And so the Chinese reformed Buddhism. And they allowed Buddhist priests to marry. And in fact, what they especially enjoyed was a sutra that came from India, in which a layman, who was a wealthy merchant called Vimalakirti, out-argued all the other disciples of Buddha. And of course, you know, if in these are these dialectic arguments that are very, very intense things. If you win the argument, everybody else has to be your disciple. So Vimalakirti, the layman, won the debate, even with Manjushri, who is the bodhisattva of supreme wisdom. They all had, you see, a contest to define the void. And all of them gave their definitions. Finally, Manjushri gave his. And Vimalakirti was asked then for his definition, and he said nothing. And so he won the whole argument. The thunderous silence.
This concludes Out of Your Mind, essential listening from the Alan Watts Audio Archives. Music by Stephen McNamara. For more information on the audio archives of Alan Watts, please visit www.alanwatts.com. For additional copies of this audio learning series, or for a complete catalog of audio, video, and music for the inner life, please visit Sounds True on the World Wide Web, www.soundstrue.com, or call Sounds True 800-333-9185, or write the Sounds True catalog, P.O. Box 8010, Boulder, Colorado 80306. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.